Wednesday night edition of the pod, and wanted to do things a little bit backwards today. We're actually going to start with a few mailbag questions submitted by our Patreon subscribers. Patreon.com/Duncan LaRue is how you subscribe there. We're going to have a full mailbag pod with the rest of these questions coming up, but we had a few that we wanted to get to as well here on the free program. So let's get right to it here, Danny. Anybody's question really showing out for you here?
We can start with one from Brian, which changed a little bit since it was asked, but not much. So the question was that prior to the season, the Twitter consensus or whatever was that the Sixers would be better served having Dario Saric come off the bench, as his skill set was redundant with Simmons. But the starting five, basically including both those, has been among the league's best. That's toned down a little bit. Moving forward, does it make sense to trot out some iteration of the supersized lineup, or would the ideal include something closer to what they hope Fultz would be?
Well, I think you really need someone else who can create off a pick and roll other than Ben Simmons on this team. And Saric is not really necessarily that guy. And for all the talk about how well Saric is playing, he's taking a few more threes, not getting to the foul line quite as much. He didn't even have a high free throw rate last year. Usage is down to under 20% this year with the additional threats that they have. But he's still not really particularly efficient. 5-20 true shooting. And it's nice to have more size. It's nice to have the option of going into the post, though they've not utilized that too much. Saric's three-point shooting has looked better, but 34%, pretty much the same rate per 36 minutes as last year. So I do think ultimately you would want to have a little more shooting there because they have Covington and Redick, although Covington, you know, I don't think he's going to stay at quite the level that he's been at so far this year in terms of his percentage. It would be nice to have someone else who can attack off the dribble and also shoot. And that is what Fultz, of course, was supposed to be. And so we may look at, because remember too, they're going to have to replace Redick at some point in free agency as well. And so they don't really have another way to get that creator other than through Fultz, unless they really get one of the big stars, or they can get into the draft with that Lakers pick or the Kings pick in the next year. So I do think Saric is still better served coming off the bench unless he really improves as a shooter. He's always going to be a little limited defensively, although again, his effort on that end has been exemplary so far this year. So he has played better. That unit has looked good, better than I thought it would, but it still is not the ideal fit, in my opinion. I mean, this is a team that is ranked in the 20s in offense this season. And so you think really, especially when Simmons is out of the game, when Embiid's out of the game, they need someone who can be really a high-end offensive creator off the dribble.
When I was talking with Derek Bodner for Real Jam Radio a couple weeks ago, I posited the idea, and I wasn't necessarily advocating for this, but that Saric was that unit Zaza Pachulia, meaning that a group of Redick, Covington, Simmons, and Embiid with a competent fifth player would do well. And Saric just certainly deserves credit for his contributions to that. But I think that there are better fits that exist. He has helped the rebounding and he's a wonderful interior passer. But those aren't necessarily the strengths that you're looking for in that lineup. As you said, they need to replace Redick. And they can go in a lot of different ways. And what is really nice about having him on this contract, so it's, you know, rookie scale, so two more years that are team controlled but at low value, more importantly, and then restricted free agency, is that you can treat him as an option. You don't have to throw him by the wayside. This is always in a continuum, and you know, in case of injury to somebody else, that he can slide in and make it work to a point. But yeah, I think they need at least one more creator in the long term, and then whether it's Redick or somebody else, a knockdown shooter, and they can do a lot of different things and make that work, but I think they need at least a couple more options.
Our buddy Con Irrell, I'm actually going to go on his podcast next week, my former SBC student asks, what is your process for stats research? I like using NBA.com, bounce around, clean the gas, etc. It all depends, of course, what we're looking at, right? I think a lot of times when I want to look at just try to establish a statistical profile of a player, you know, I start just with Basketball Reference, the advanced tab, just look at his overall efficiency, true shooting percentage. I'll look at that a lot. And so get an idea just of whether in a very 10,000 foot sense, it looks like this guy has been an effective player. And especially if it's a guy who creates more often. So that's usually where I'll start. I mean, unless I already have a good feel for where that guy is at already. Then I like to look at the play type data as well to get and if we're talking about just pure stats, obviously I'll look at a lot of film too, especially if I see that there is a number that is different from what I kind of had as a preconceived notion of what this player was. But I'll look at the play type data to see, you know, how is this guy guy getting his points? Is he spotting up? Is he going in pick and roll, posting up, ISO? Get an idea of like what his offense looks like as well. Defensively, it of course is harder, but it really depends what your purpose is. If you're trying to come up with a scouting report for a guy, I mean, I think number one is just kind of getting an idea first of just generally what the statistical profile is like, and then looking at film of those type of plays to see within that category how he's been effective or not effective, as the case may be. Also, I like to look at what a guy is shooting from various zones. That's obviously something that's very useful. At the rim from three, what percentage are they taking from each range? I mean, I think if you look at all that, you can get a pretty decent idea of how a guy is playing offensively. And then on defense, obviously, then you can look at more at the on-off stuff as well. I don't look at the on-off stuff quite as much offensively, unless it's a guy who you have reason to think, hey, you know what, like he would be better than some of his stats would indicate offensively, such as a great shooter, or a guy who's really, you know, a total zero offensively, you know, a Roy Hibbert type of player. So yeah, that's about it. I mean, it really depends if you're from an individual standpoint, that's what I'll look at. And you know, when we do the 15 and 60, I mean, we watch enough that I think, Danny, you can speak to this too, that just your questions come to mind as you're watching, like, oh, this would be something interesting to look at. I mean, there's always more to learn. And so that we generally, I think, just follow our own curiosities.
Right. And I was thinking about it more from a team perspective. And for me, if I have a question that I want answered, I generally know where I'm going to be looking. So one of the useful tabs that I've been going to a fair amount is on Cleaning the Glass. You can go to the team pages and you can basically get kind of the equivalent of like the four factors page and the shooting page, but you can compare it to that team's other historical data. So for example, that was a really nice resource when I was doing the comparison of the Raptors offense in terms of shot distribution for prior seasons. So you get that context. And then on the other part of that same page, you can see success. And so those are two parts of the same coin. So like, for example, I was another one was I was trying to figure out, well, I still am, what's going on with the Blazers defense. And so you could see, okay, well, the shots they're forcing are largely similar, but maybe an opponent is being way more successful at something. In that case, it's 3-point shooting. So they, you know, in prior years, they were getting bad luck with 3-point shooters. And this year they've been getting better luck. I don't know if that changed with the Bradley Beal game, but so you get into that. And sometimes what I do, and you can tell if for people who listen closely to a 15 and 60, you can tell when I've done something like this because you start to hear the similar stats, is sometimes I just go on like I call it kind of a fishing expedition where I pick a couple of things and I'm just like, is there anything here that looks wrong? And if there's something that looks wrong or something that's really an extreme that I wasn't necessarily anticipating, then I'll throw that. And I often do that on like Friday or Saturday, because then that can inform. And like, sometimes I throw it to you or to Liam or to myself as an idea of like, hey, maybe we could look into this. And so that happens too. So sometimes it could be like opponent shooting percentage at the rim, or it could be, you know, anything. And then the other element that you just get more comfortable with time is just knowing where to look for specific things. So like, I use NBA.com's on off tool. I think that's a really good one. I'm not even sure the right way to get there. I just have it saved as a bookmark, so that's how I get there. And then you can use, there's an impact tool there, NBA Wowie if you're getting into some of the more complicated on-offs. And so you figure that stuff out with time, with trial and error, and by people telling you about new stuff. But I have gone more to Cleaning the Glass because I really do like the idea of filtering out non-representative time. I think part of that is also being so familiar with the Golden State Warriors and knowing that their garbage time is particularly non-representative. And so I was just like, okay, you know, filtering that stuff out, I think that leads to a better base of information. And so you need to know what you're looking for, and also like just tool around, just find different stuff. I mean, every once in a while, and sometimes the stuff you find isn't perfect. And sometimes like I had one where a bunch of people were retweeted because I had a positive thing about Joel Embiid with the difference in opponent field goal percentage. And then I was about to tweet out the thing about just at the rim, and a bunch of people were like, oh, you know, that's a better stat. And I'm like, I know, I was about to tweet at the same time. So know all that, but you know, just tool around and find something fun.
All right, lots more to get to on the mailbag. Also, also got to talk about the two games we did tonight for the Twitter NBA show, Clippers, Minnesota, and Charlotte, Golden State. But first, this from our friends at Blinds.com. The copy they gave me, it says that you don't usually think about blinds. That's kind of true, though. As an observant person, I probably have always looked at blinds a little bit more, especially bad ones. Like, for me, it's not even that they look cheap, but it's just when, like, the mechanism is not really that good to, like, open or close them. Like, it doesn't, like, the house we moved into has, like, a few blinds there, and it has, like, this chain mechanism that is, I don't really enjoy it. Like, you have to pull it, like, so far to actually get the blinds to go down. Then, like, it gets in the way of the chain when they actually go down. So when they're wrong, it's just, it's not good. We have a ton of windows in our house. We got to get some blinds. Going to go to blinds.com, where they offer a free online design consultation if you need help getting started. I worked with a wonderful woman named Danielle the last time I worked with blinds.com. You can send in pictures of your home. You can get custom professional recommendations in return. They'll send you free samples to make everything look just as good in person. And shipping is free. And if you mismeasure or pick the wrong color, they will remake your blinds for free. So there's really no risk of that happening. By the way, quick aside, you remember how I used to complain about my blinds at the place we rented? Because, like, they're installed improperly, my cheap landlord is trying to actually charge us because they got messed up. And because he was too lazy to install them properly, and then they got messed up as we tried to, like, operate them normally, and so now he's trying to actually charge us like $500 to replace it, which I can't believe that. But anyway, looks like he will have to go to blinds.com too, because I'm certainly not paying that. And maybe they can get blinds.com can help teach him how to install it properly. Maybe I'll send that to him in my latest letter when I tell him that we're not paying that, that he can use the promo code CAPSPACE and get 20% off everything at blinds.com. That's blinds.com, promo code CAPSPACE. You can get 20% off everything: faux wood blind, cellular shades, roller shades, and more. Blinds.com, promo code CAPSPACE. Rules and restrictions apply. Let them know that you came from us. So let's see. Next here, Marcus Mitchell asks, what is the functional difference between an offense heavy in dribble handoffs compared to one with more traditional pick and roll? Do the two plays have distinct advantages and disadvantages given certain personnel? And what I would say to that is absolutely. DHOs make more use of bigs who can pass and make decisions around the perimeter. DHOs much more often take place on the wing. You don't see as much. We've seen a little bit more of that Spanulis pick and roll, which is actually a handoff. I talked about that extensively when I had Aaron Jackson on the show over the summer, and the Jazz run a lot of that now for Donovan Mitchell. He used to run it for Gordon Hayward. But generally, DHOs will occur on the side. But the good thing about DHOs is it's really tough for the defense to keep the ball out of the middle on those plays. Usually a side pick and roll now, everybody is there to ice it. But if you're flying off a DHO, it's much harder for the defense to send you towards the baseline. You can get middle if the guy doesn't just completely break it up. And so the prevalence of DHOs really is what has made both defense and offense much more tiring, because you see guys just rocketing off out of the corner for those DHOs. And with dribble handoffs, I think you got to have bigs who can make decisions. You know, I mean, if you're, and you got to have bigs that you need to guard outside as well. And then it also helps, of course, on a DHO, if you have a guy who can shoot if you go under it. Because I think on a DHO, it's really easier to shoot a three from the wing because you don't have to dribble first. You can just get the handoff and stop and pop if the guy goes under on you. And so if you have good personnel, DHOs work a little bit better too, I think, for wing players, maybe not necessarily for just straight up pick and roll guys. It's harder to switch those as well, and you still get some of that rolling to the basket too from the side if you can get middle, because a lot of times the big will have to step up and help. But you know, if you have like a great regular point guard, or you have a great dive man in pick and roll, you know, John Wall, Marcin Gortat, like those guys work a little bit more in high pick and roll. Beal, he'll work a little bit more on the side too. And the other nice thing about a DHO is you can switch sides of the floor pretty easily, and so there's definitely, I think those work if you have the right personnel extremely well. And it also has the advantage of, hey, at least the big gets to touch the ball, right? A DHO is usually going to occur when you've at least reversed the ball from side to side. And, you know, a pick and roll can be a DHO too. A lot of times you'll see now where if they try to do a side pick and roll, as the big is coming over, they'll just throw him the ball and then try to rock it to the middle of the floor and get the ball back. It's basically a pick and roll, but it's kind of a DHO. So there's so many ways to kind of put those two things together. But those are what I see as the relative advantages and disadvantages.
One thing I wanted to ask you, just anecdotally to me, it seems like they call fewer illegal screens on DHOs than they do on pick and rolls, at least like kind of per capita or per incidence. Does that make sense to you? Like that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure about that. I think it is probably the case that it's a little bit harder to get a good screen on a DHO because you're also worrying at the same time about dribbling the ball. I mean, you're dribbling the ball at the same time as you're trying to get in position for the screen. You've got to do the handoff. You can't just do like the little like quick Al Horford elbow that we demonstrated on the Twitter NBA show today, where you kind of, you know, get outside the cone of your body, and then, you know, you're also vulnerable to kind of spinning around and stuff. But the nice thing about a DHO is it's much easier to go backdoor too, right? So you can't, if you dribble at the guy then and you're worried about getting cut off, you can go backdoor. I mean, that doesn't really necessarily answer your question, but it occurred to me. So, you know, I don't think that you're going to see more illegal screens. I think it's easier to set a good screen on a straight up pick and roll. You can flip the angle of the screen on a straight up pick and roll as well from out top. I mean, a lot of it too is just simply the difference because between doing a DHO on the side and a high screen roll, you know, a lot of that is kind of the difference too. But I do think it's easier to get a good screen when you are up top. But, you know, from the side, it's kind of tougher to see whether, you know, a foul has been committed. But I think it, as a big, if you're trying to dribble the ball, setting that screen is difficult.
I think this one will be faster. From Dimitrik Edwards asked, is it feasible for the NBA to adopt a system like baseball where you get drafted out of high school, but attending college, you have to go for at least 2 years? Would this help make the G League a viable minor league for the NBA? And the answer to the is it feasible question is yes. I mean, they could do that if they wanted to. The fundamental problem with it, though, is a very basic question, which is who benefits? And if going to that, and I'm saying that as opposed to just going with a straight, you can leave whenever you want rule, the biggest beneficiary there are colleges. The NBA does not benefit from that as much as, and our mutual friend Ethan Sherwood-Strauss talks about this a lot, that you're feeding a competitor who, it's not like you play on a different day or anything like that. College games are broadcast on many of the same networks at the same times. And so, yeah, college coaches would get greater continuity, but there, and college isn't as good for developing players as the NBA is broadly. There are, of course, exceptions to that, but generally speaking. So I don't think it would help in that way. I do think that having high school kids being able to come out would lead to greater importance for the G League, just because that would be an option for players, and that would be a good thing, because it would just, for certain players, you would just want to give them that time. So it is, I would, if forced to make the choice between that system and the current one, I would probably choose that, but I support something that is neither of those.
Yeah, and this whole idea of a viable minor league, so you get drafted and you go play in the G League, but you're not under an NBA contract, you know, that doesn't really make a ton of sense there. Players wouldn't necessarily want to do that. So,
well, and then,
I mean, I understand what viable minor league means. I mean, I guess it just like baseball, where, you know, your guys are only playing in the minor leagues and getting developed. I mean, I think, you know, there's the call-up system works a little bit better. If there's guys who really need to play in the G League with the affiliate team, they can, but they should still be on NBA contracts and be on the NBA roster.
Right. And the other important part of this to differentiate is that the best 18-year-old basketball players can absolutely play in the NBA. This has been established. There isn't any argument on this, whereas it can be more complicated in baseball. And even in baseball, you know, the best players have the ability to go up. I definitely would not support a system where, especially if players had already been drafted, where they were not allowed to play in the NBA once they were already under control of an NBA team. That just wouldn't make any sense to me. And also, there are a lot of parts of baseball that I'm uncomfortable with, the wages that a lot of those guys get, and they have less control over the process. So there's, and the whole gaming the system with like, oh, he's going to spend an extra couple days down in the minors so that doesn't kick in another year. I think it's good that basketball, you can't game those kinds of systems. I think that's a very good thing. So I could see elements of that coming in. And I do think that having the 30 G League teams eventually will be a big help, just because the convenience of it for NBA teams. And I mean, maybe there will still be teams in Sioux Falls and things like that, but at least then there's a direct line and the incentive structure is aligned. And that's a very good thing.
Christian Nissen, what player do you see as the biggest talent whose career was either partially or completely ruined by injuries? He says Tracy McGrady and Brandon Roy top his list. And let's just brainstorm here about some that come to mind. Derrick Rose, obviously. Greg Oden is just a massive one, of course. Ralph Sampson, another who comes to mind. Bernard King, although he had more of a career than people realize before he actually was injured, comes to mind as well. Grant Hill.
Grant Hill is my number one
too. Yeah.
Penny Hardaway is certainly one that can be discussed. But yeah, for me, it's Grant Hill, because we got to see Grant Hill kind of before he got really saddled by it. And he was an MVP caliber player. Like, I don't know how many he would have ended up winning, but he was that level of talent. Brandon Roy was special.
I wouldn't go that far. I don't think he ever
Didn't he finish third one year?
That's possible, because they had one year where like they randomly won like 56 games when he was in Detroit. So maybe that's possible. I don't know that if he was on the top five, he was kind of very much towards the bottom there. But, you know, just to like, because we do this thing sometimes, and not that you're necessarily doing it with Hill because he was a fantastic player, but where we kind of like almost overrate these guys who got hurt. And that's a little bit, I think, to like, okay, let's try to be realistic here. Like, just because we didn't see this guy as absolute peak, like trying to say that he would have been better than like, you know, Jordan or LeBron or something. Not that you're saying that either, but some people kind of go that way.
96-97, he finished third. He was 24 years old, averaged 21.4 points, 9 rebounds, 7.3 assists. Jordan finished second, Malone finished third. So, and that was the year Hardaway finished fourth, and Glenn Rice actually finished fifth. So it was definitely a different kind of year in terms of the MVP. But I mean, if you can get that close at 24, I think you're in the conversation. And like, I loved Brandon Roy. He was the one for me that was the most emotionally challenging, because we went to college at the same time at different schools, but I admired the hell out of him. But I don't think he was the level of player. And then Greg Oden, I've said before that I would have to wonder if this is still true, but there was a time when he was the best college player I ever saw play in person. And that might still be true. I'd have to really go back and start logging some stuff. But I was there in the Final Four that he played in Atlanta, and he was jaw-dropping as a talent.
I'd say probably Markel Fultz. Sorry, Philly fans, just kidding. Oden is it, because I mean, you could say one way or the other, Oden was considered the best big man prospect basically since Tim Duncan, and even maybe as a better prospect than Tim Duncan when he came out. I mean, this is even, you know, before he went to Ohio State, he was considered that level of player, and he would have been real good. Yeah, go ahead.
What about Bill Walton?
Yeah, no, that's actually a pretty good one to me. I guess it's just, do you want to decide between a guy who was awesome and Walton won the 78 MVP despite missing a bunch of games? They were, you know, 50-10 or whatever it was when he got hurt with the MVP, and then it really only had one other good year, that 86 year. And, you know, I mean, if you see him today, he certainly, you know, he still is in pain with his feet from that time. So yeah, that's Walton is definitely one as well who should be on the list. Even Elgin Baylor, you know, I mean, do you want to take the guys who played at a real high level for 5 or 6 years, you know, your Grant Hill, your Penny Hardaway, do you want to go with your Bill Walton or Derrick Rose, who played at a really high level for like, you know, 1 or 2 years and then really were kind of gone? Sampson was kind of in that category as well. Or is it just the never was is like Greg Oden is? I mean, he's probably the biggest just never was in terms of someone who, I mean, keep in mind that most people thought that he should be drafted over Kevin Durant. I mean, that's how good he was. And it's easy to look back now and say, yeah, there's no way that Oden would have been as good as Durant just because Durant has been so absolutely incredible in his own right. But I mean, Oden's talent was he, as a physical specimen, you know, I'd say he's probably didn't have the jump shot that Joel Embiid has, and maybe not quite the skill level, but as good of a defensive player, I'd say he's pretty similar to Joel in terms of his defensive impact, and then really more explosive than Embiid around the rim. I mean, I'll still remember they showed this missed dunk on one shining moment when he took off in the championship game from like beyond the dotted line off at 2 feet and almost just dunked on like the whole Florida team in that 2007 championship game.
Yeah, I mean, so I wasn't at that game. I was at the game before. That was against Georgetown, I believe, when he just beasted on Roy Hibbert. And Oden, like, he was a different type of player. player than Embiid. But remember, he was before all those guys. You know, like there were no that new generation of centers when Oden came up. He was that guy. And, you know, it ended up not happening. And it's so unfortunate in a lot of those ways. But I mean, that's the way you have to deal with it. I know a lot of people. I mean, I wanted to mention Penny. We talked about just mentioned it briefly just because he was, I don't think he was as great a player as a lot of those, but in terms of influential and just fun to watch, I think he's in the conversation.
Yeah, especially when he played point guard too, when Shaq was still there. I thought he became less interesting when he became a shooting guard. But when he played point guard, and like, you know, they also had Nick Anderson who could post up on that team. And that Magic team, 95 Magic, is one of the greatest offenses of all time. And helped in part by the fact that they moved the three-point line in that year. But, you know, he could get in the post against smaller players. He'd blow by guys, get to the rim, a explosive finisher, great passer. Like he definitely, as a young guy, was incredible to watch. And yeah, I think that's David Thompson. I mean, he obviously, I mean, if you want to get into people who had, like, you know, personal problems, and then he ended up like tearing up his knee as well, I think by like falling at a club. But, you know, you could probably already say it by that point that his career had really gone downhill. But he's another guy, and he was a dominant player the first couple years of his career. Okay, one more here. David Anderson, what are the differences between NCAA and NBA basketball that you account for when evaluating a prospect?
Oh, it's a lot of different things. I mean, the prevalence of zone defenses is a really big one, just in terms of, I was thinking about that because we saw Wes Johnson play today, and I was remembering the defensive questions with him. Before the last couple of years, the shot clock was a really big one, but I would say by and large, the biggest one is just the difference in talent. And that's both as teammates and as opponents, the amount of games that college players play against NBA caliber athletes, you know, it makes it tough, because the speed and the reaction times in the NBA are so fundamentally different. So I would say that's where I start. And so and that's also why sometimes, even though they often occur before, those high-end youth basketball tournaments can be a very important thing, because that's when you can see the, you know, especially if it's not one of the US versus world, unless the talent is balanced, where you can see those guys play more regularly against really, really good players.
Yeah, I mean, much as people bitch about AAU, I think that kind of basketball in some ways is more useful for evaluating someone for the NBA game than college basketball, because it is just such a weird system. I think there's a few things that pop out to me. Is in college, like, guys just get a lot of calls that you're just not going to get in the NBA, especially at the rim on verticality stuff, where if you just kind of, and there's a specific type of college player too, that's just, you know, the Evan Turner type of guy who's just like strong, experienced, can kind of get to a spot in the lane, but he's not really beating his guy. And then, you know, he might just get fouled, because anytime you get close to the basket and shoot in college, you get a foul call. And I definitely distinguish between, you know, what's a pro move and what's a college move. You know, if you're just kind of getting in the lane, not beating your man, and throwing up, like, you know, a short floater or a short jump shot or something against college players, you're not even, you know, able to blow by your man. I mean, that's always an issue for me. If you're talking about a guy who's supposed to be like a scoring prospect, especially a wing in college, if you're not able to blow by somebody and really create separation at the college level, you can still score at the college level, even if you can't do that. But those guys generally do not do very well in the NBA. You know, I would look at it as like a Dwayne Bacon type was another guy like that, right? And we've seen him struggle to be efficient so far in the NBA. I mean, not to single him out, there's plenty of other guys.
Would you have Adam Morrison in that group? Because I would.
Oh, of course I would.
I think he's he was the one that made me realize, because the fundamental difference between creation in college and creation in the
He could at least shoot threes, which makes it a little bit easier.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, and especially, you know, I forget whether he was a junior or senior. I think he was a junior when he came out. But yeah, so you see moves where they're just kind of, all right, you know, you're just powering through, you know, you're not really beating your guy. Like that's kind of what comes to mind. And then also guys who will play hard defensively, even though they're a big star, because it's very rare that you're going to be a big enough star that you're not going to be able to, your ability to get away with not playing hard defensively in the NBA and have it not kill your team. So that's another thing I'll look at too, is where, you know, who just intrinsically has the level of motivation to play hard, even when they're the big star, even when, you know, they're there in a one and done and they got recruited there and the coach doesn't really have much in the way of leverage over them. Are you just the type of player who will play hard on your own? Are you a kind of a self-starter?
The first guy I thought of when you said that was Marcus Smart. There were elements of his game that's, his jumper scared the crap out of me, but his competitiveness was really inspiring. And that was why I didn't fight as hard against the people who had him higher than I did.
Let's talk about this Wolves-Clippers game first. Not the most exciting slate in the league, but good to catch up with a couple of teams we haven't talked about much, especially the Clippers, you know, since this Blake Griffin injury. Danilo Gallinari returning. He played 26 minutes, but really struggled, only 2 of 13 from the field. The jumper, he had some bad misses. It appeared to be on a minutes limit as well. They started both he and Wes Johnson at Ford, and then DeAndre Jordan in his national TV audition for his next team had a wonderful game with 18 points, 21 rebounds, 12 offensive rebounds.
Austin Rivers helped make him look good, not because of the beautiful lobs. Those mostly came from Lou Williams. And who was the other guy who had just a spectacular one to him? I'm trying to remember who that was. But it was because a lot of what his offensive rebounds were was guys taking drives to the rim and missing the shot, and DeAndre Jordan being in the right place, especially when the Minnesota bigs, often Karl-Anthony Towns, were going for the block. And, you know, sometimes they needed to. There was an urgency there. And then he would clean it up. And sometimes it was also cleaning up his own misses. But DeAndre was dominant in that way. It was one of the better offensive rebounding performances I can remember this season. I'm trying to remember last year. I think there were a couple of really strong ones too. I think, was it Dwight Drummond? I know Drummond had at least one.
Well, it was no Jakob Poeltl against the Warriors.
Oh, Jesus, that's close. Right. But so you had that going for the Clippers. And then the other takeaway from their perspective, beyond Gallo just struggling to generate reliable offense, and he's come back from 13 games off with a glute injury, I'm not concerned about that, was Lou Williams was just so much fun to watch in that second half. I mean, there were so many moments where it looked like the Timberwolves were going to take control. They were the better team overall in the game, and then Lou Williams would just make a crazy three, or he would drive to the basket and hit somebody, whatever it needed to be. And it was also a reminder of kind of the differences between him and Jamal Crawford, because A, the shots he's getting are better, and B, he is so much better at those shots at this point in their respective careers.
Yeah, that's true. And Crawford, 10 shots in 17 minutes in his return. The Clippers played a nice tribute video for him after his 5 years in LA. And I always do like to give Crawford credit that, you know, I certainly didn't believe that he would still be in the league and still a rotation player at this point in his career. You know, I mean, we were reminiscing about how he signed that mid-level exception deal with the Clippers right after the lockout, and or it might have actually been the season after the lockout. But I thought that was a bad deal at the time, and still he is here in the league years later. And but you're right, you know, Lou Williams was unbelievable in this game, played 37 minutes. Makes you question that maybe he should have started, because he had to basically play the entire, you know, he got the Mirotić where he just played the entire rest of the first half after sitting in the beginning. And I think same thing in the second half, but he had it rolling, especially in the second half. He was actually kicking Jimmy Butler's ass at times, like just blowing past him to the left and pulling up, getting into the lane. He had 8 assists as well as some beautiful alley-oops to DeAndre Jordan. And then it had a play where Butler just fell asleep off the ball, and Lou just sprinted into a dribble handoff and hit another three. It was 4 of 9 from three. And Rivers, while people were critical of him handling the ball too much and not getting it to Lou late, Rivers did have 23 points and was able to get to the rim and finish often enough.
Yeah.
Especially around Karl-Anthony Towns, whose rim protection, he had a couple of plays in this game, but generally it was its usual lacking nature.
Well, the other thing that Rivers did, which ended up being important, he only made 2 threes, but they were, I believe, in pretty quick succession in that second quarter when the game was right, getting away from the Clippers. And you could make an argument that without those 2 threes, this game gets out of hand either at the late second quarter or the third quarter. And Rivers, you know, he has the high profile misses, but then he does make other shots. And so, you know, he did end the game 9 of 18 from the field with 23 points. So I don't want to give him too much crap. It just seemed like all of his misses were of that specific variety. And we talked a little bit about Towns Suns' defense, but he is such a special offensive player. His touch around the basket is incredible. He, at certain moments in the game, especially early on, it didn't feel like he was getting enough touches, but then later on, he did exert his will more frequently and ended up with a nice overall night, especially considering he got four blocks. So, of course, he had a great defensive performance.
Yeah, wouldn't go that far, but four blocks and two steals does help you a little bit, and he did have four turnovers. The Clippers' strategy initially was they're going to put DeAndre Jordan on Taj Gibson and then actually put Gallinari on Towns, I think in part because Towns likes to shoot from the outside. He has not been, it seems to me, as active shooting the three-pointer this year as he was last year under Tibbs, which is a surprise. You would have thought that he'd be used as a spacer a little bit more than he has been. He only took two threes in this one. But for Towns, 21 points as well, and had four assists. They were just doubling him every time. That was the plan. And Towns is either able to start some rotations around, or they are able to find Taj Gibson in the first half. And Taj, I think, had all seven of his field goals in the first half, was set up quite a bit in the second half, but unfortunately his maddening tendency to bring the ball down to his waist before he goes up got him stripped a few times.
The other guy that I wanted to single out a little bit was Wes Johnson. Had a wonderful defensive game in the second half, working hard all over. Sometimes it was help defense, sometimes it was just on making life hard on his man, whoever that was Jimmy a lot of the time. And you know, that's an important part of it this year. I mean, they lost Luke Richard and Bob Mute to the Rockets and didn't really replace him, and they don't have that go-to wing defender, but this was the best defensive game I can remember from him.
Yeah, he caused some problems from Jimmy Butler more as a help defender, had a couple of really nice blocked shots as well. I think he got Taj Gibson on one drive, which was pretty impressive. For the Clippers, they basically, Willie Reed did not play. Teodosic still a couple of games before he comes back from injury. So they went with Montrezl Harrell, who had a nice statistical game. He had 8 points on 4 of 5. Jamil Wilson on a two-way out of Marquette was actually plus 10, a stretch four, but also a guy with some defensive versatility and switching. And Sam Decker, who we thought could be a big piece for this team, even when they were healthy, he's been completely beaten out by Wes Johnson at this point, only playing 6 minutes and hasn't really been playing much even with Gallo out. And I actually liked okay what I saw from another two-way guy, CJ Williams, who actually started in this one, got the Keith Bogans in both halves, but I thought he looked the best defensively of all the Clippers guards, at least.
Yeah, I would say that. And it was another periodically maddening game from Andrew Wiggins. He has this so often where when he exerts his physical will on a game, he can do some really impressive stuff out there. I mean, he had one dunk in transition that was really nice. He had another one where he cut to the basket at exactly the right time, got the pass, and was able to finish with some authority. And so you see those plays and then you go, oh, and then he has all these other ones where he's settling for shots, sometimes because he's comfortable with it, sometimes because he couldn't get something better. And that mix is probably going to be a part of it for him. Like, it's not guaranteed moving forward, but we're getting closer to the point where it's like, okay, this is just part of the Andrew Wiggins experience. And he is getting better defensively, certainly. But again, the idea of
baby steps.
But the idea, again, of consistency, like, I wonder, because I think he's still leading the league in minutes, at least minutes per game. And whether, like, if just to get his brain going that way, if Tibbs could ever just see, like, I'm only going to play you 28 minutes, play, you know, 95% effort or whatever, you know, you don't ask a guy to play 100% all the time, but, you know, like, whatever that level is, and then just see what that looks like on a more consistent basis. Because when he's on, Wiggins is, he's close to undeniable just as a physical talent.
Yeah, a few too many mid-rangers again from him. And it was an interesting, you know, this Minnesota team, we talked about it during the broadcast, that their offense is very effective, but it doesn't really look the same. You know, you don't feel like, oh man, these guys are really dominating. You know, they're getting to the free throw line, they didn't so much today. They're scoring around the rim, they're getting offensive rebounds, they're not shooting a ton of threes. Jeff Teague took a bunch of theirs and actually hit four threes in this one. Four of his six field goals made were threes. But generally, you know, they don't have a ton of spot up shooting on this team. I still worry about their shot distribution. Towns and Butler combined for 26 field goal attempts, and Wiggins and Crawford combined for 26 field goal attempts. And that, you know, Butler and Towns are extremely efficient, and you know, Wiggins and Crawford are not. Butler, 43 minutes in this one, in a game that, you know, the Wolves were pretty comfortably ahead. I think the closest it got ever was five. But as the Clippers were making their comeback, it was Butler's usual rest time, and so he only ended up resting, you know, 2.5 minutes in the second half.
And we talked about this a little bit on the broadcast, but my general opinion is that a team as good as they are, and yes, I understand that they have the playoff drought, should understand that it's early December. There's a lot more of the season left. And yes, Jimmy Butler has been pretty incredible in terms of, you know, being able to handle minute workload. But then remember, he missed time 2 years ago, and that really devastated the Bulls season. If we already saw what it looked like without him in those two games early this season when they got absolutely crushed. So working him as hard as they did to make this win more likely when it was already pretty likely is concerning in a similar way to how it's concerning for the Rockets. The difference is that the Rockets are way better, and so it actually in some ways is more infuriating with them because they're going to win those games anyway. And a lot of times they've already won and they're just keeping those guys in like Harden for stat padding.
Yeah, and I know you were critical during the broadcast of Tibbs only playing eight guys, and my question was, hey, you know, who else do you want to play? I mean, you can play eight guys, but it's more, you know, I think maybe they could try playing Tyus Jones a little bit more. He was effective when he started for Teague when he had that Achilles issue, and Teague was playing well today, but maybe you could even try playing those two guys together, especially against, you know, a Clippers team. You know, I guess if one of them has to guard Lou Williams, that's not perfect. And, you know, 21 minutes for Jang, 17 for Crawford, that's kind of about right, and they're missing Nemanja Bjelica so far. But you know, the hope is that Butler doesn't go down. If he does, they could be in trouble once again here. Anything else you want to say on this one before we continue?
Well, the one other thing, because we just didn't make this a basic point, is that the Wolves were shooting like 70% at halftime. It was ridiculously efficient,
yeah,
game for them.
70% true shooting, yeah.
Yeah, 70% true shooting, but they were over 60% from the field as well, like, because they don't shoot any threes. Remember, like, true shooting with the team that in that point, there weren't many fouls in the beginning of this game. It doesn't get to the line too much. They were making the shots they got, and there were the turnovers. I can't remember when the turnovers kicked in, but yeah, we talked about how slow a comeback it started.
I mean, they had like a 120 offensive rating for most of the game, and they were turning it over on like 25% of their possessions for most of the game.
It's ridiculous. That was a part of the story of the game that I just wanted to have out there.
Yeah, and also too, I thought DeAndre Jordan, for all of his brilliance on offense with the alley-oops and the offensive rebounds, really a non-factor defensively in this game.
Yeah, I mean, I would say their best defensive player was Wes Johnson.
Yeah, I agree with you there. All right, we still got to get to Golden State and Charlotte, and also a little bit of news too. But first, this from Movement Watches. If you're an international listener, Movement Watches, a great way to support the podcast. And of course, you go to that movement.com, mvmt.com/capspace URL to get 15% off. And of course, to track them, let them know that you came from us. They sell watches to 160 countries, and they've sold over 1 million so far with their classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. I'm a big fan of their 40 series, 40 millimeters. It's a little bit smaller for me. And they, of course, make awesome gifts. My mom, in fact, has utilized Movement Watches to get gifts for her nieces. My cousin, my fiance, really likes hers a lot as well. Danny likes his. Danny was getting all kinds of compliments today on the Twitter show for how well he was dressed. So you know that Danny's taste is certainly the arbiter of what you should be buying, or what you should be buying for someone else. I mean, it's really easy to just go to that site, mvmt.com, movement.com/capspace, and just check out all the watches that they have there. I think you'll find one that you like, and you'll find it at a price that you will love. Man, I really should be writing this copy. I just completely ad-libbed that. They start at just $95, and I find them comparable to what you'd be getting, you know, $400 to $500 at a department store. So once again, way to get started with them, mvmt.com, movement.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us and join the movement. So we speculated on last night's program what the Warriors were going to look like with Steph Curry out. Then we found out that Draymond Green did not play due to left shoulder soreness, and then Zaza Pachulia out after 4 minutes with his own shoulder issues going against Dwight Dwight Howard. And what we did see was a very Kevin Durant-centric attack as he dominated to the tune of 35 points, 11 rebounds, and 10 assists on 31 shooting possessions.
And while that was great, and we'll get back there, the big number for me with this game was Charlotte missing 27 shots in the restricted area. They were 20 of 47 in the restricted area, and that 47 is a ridiculous number of attempts.
Yeah, and 46 of those were missed by Michael Carter Williams.
I mean, and so you run into a problem when you see a number like that, because there's a part of you that wants to go, oh, look at how good the Warriors' rim protection was, even in a game when Draymond Green didn't play. And there were elements of that in place. There were a fair number of those that were contested. But there was also a significant portion of those misses that were just guys like MCW, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. I don't have his splits in front of me, but it feels like he missed at least... Oh, well,
I mean, Kidd-Gilchrist, he got like 5 layups blocked just in the third quarter. I might be exaggerating, but it was definitely at least 4. And these were like, if they didn't get blocked, they were just like, you know, no hope layups that, like, to avoid getting blocked, he had to throw it, like, you know, off the top corner of the backboard that just had no chance of going in. I mean, he was going directly into guys like Jordan Bell and KD. I thought that Bell had another nice game starting at the 4. He's actually been effective starting at the 4, despite the fact that he doesn't bring a ton of shooting to the table. He had 3 blocks in his 20 minutes, 4 assists as well, continues to show great passing vision. But yeah, I mean, it was, so I did think maybe the Warriors' contribution to that was underrated. You know, Carter Williams definitely missed some pretty uncontested ones, including one that was just like, you know, a practice gym layup pretty much wide open by himself. And that was a huge play too, because that could have cut it from 7-5. And instead, the Warriors came down. I think they banged a 3 right after that. And it really never got close after that point.
One of the other dynamics in this game that was important to note is the beginning of the second quarter, the Warriors went to a different second unit. They had to, because Draymond Green's usually in that. And so what they did is they went small. They went, I mean, small is a relative term here. Because they went with Iguodala power forward. It was Livingston, Klay Thompson, Nick Young, and then David West, who actually played in both the first and third quarters, each of those for the first time this year due to the absences of Pachulia and Green, and especially the surprise absence of Pachulia because he started the game, so they couldn't go with their normal rotations. And that lineup generated a metric ton of turnovers and really swung the game. I mean, the Warriors led by, I think it was about 22 or 24 in midway through the second quarter. And then from that point on, I would say Charlotte loosely outplayed them. But when you build that sort of a lead, you can cede a lot of ground and still be doing pretty well.
Yeah, and David West actually played in the first and third quarters, mostly due to the Pachulia injury, I think. And we also saw Frank Kaminsky on a drive suffer a kind of an odd sprained right ankle. He didn't really like land on anybody. He just sprained it, and he was unable to return. Dwight Howard, he was bricking shots around the rim. He was effective in terms of deterring shots right at the basket, but doesn't get out on the floor at all. And Klay Thompson, who had another just fantastic game. I mean, he's well on his way to that 50-40-90 season at this point with 22 points on only 14 shots for him, 4 of 7 on threes. And so he was able to get open a lot by screening with Howard's man, and Howard certainly is not going to leave the paint at this point in his career. So it was really a struggle for the Hornets. They also, you know, got 14 offensive rebounds, but just were not really able to get any kind of second chance points at all, which was a surprise. But they just, you know, would blow the layup again, or they just tip it around and wouldn't ever really be able to control it. And so, you know, I didn't think that this was a game that played like a 14 point difference, especially as you mentioned, after the Warriors went up by 20, Charlotte outplayed them, but is a very limited offensive team. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, you know, was 3 for 11. They weren't guarding him at all. And Kevin Durant just absolutely put Kidd-Gilchrist in the torture chamber in this game.
And Durant had so I talked about how the second quarter had that big stretch. Durant had 16 points just in the first quarter alone. Early on, it looked like it was going to be the Durant and Thompson show, because I think they had 6 of the team's first 7 shots, and then Durant just started taking all of them and was making it. And MKG is certainly a defensive talent, but it was a reminder of just how special and how unusual the absolute best of the best are. And, you know, there were plays where I thought MKG did a good job. There were a couple also, like, you think about how much stronger Durant is now than when he came into the league, where he straight up bumped MKG off of him and then shot. And that's not, you know, obviously the Kevin Durant that couldn't lift the bar at the combine was a little bit different, but he's a phenomenal talent in just getting his own shot. And he had a couple of nice nice passes in this game. That was how he got to a triple-double. He also had a couple bad ones. That is a part and parcel of the experience for him right now. And it was also interesting to see the Warriors try to deal with Dwight Howard, because he had a couple of times where he was actually handling the ball and got JaVale McGee in a little bit of trouble. And they tried Kevon Looney at one point, and that didn't really work. And so then that's also when necessity was the mother invention in terms of having David West start the second half, because West was the Warriors' best big on Dwight Howard.
Yeah, and West continues to have a great season. You know, his hands defensively, I mean, against all but the most athletic guys, he's really still, he's got that 7'4 wingspan, as well as, his, you know, seemingly everyone on the Warriors. Any other Charlotte observations on this? Actually, you know, I was really impressed by the defense of Travion Graham, and he actually hit his 1 3-pointer as well. I mean, he had one sequence that we tweeted out from our intern, Ben Dull, that tweeted it out, but you can go back and see it at Nate Duncan NBA during the game, where he denied Thompson on a flare cut when the ball was in the post, and then also denied him on the ensuing backdoor. It was really a nice play by Graham, and I thought he really got into Thompson. And then Charlotte played much better in the second half, in part because, first of all, they hit 2 threes with Kemba Walker, like right at the end of the first half, that kind of got them back into contact after they had been down by 20. They were down 15 at half. And then they just played much harder defense. Like Nicola Batum got hot offensively, just hitting some tough long twos. And then also he was terrible defensively on Klay Thompson in the first half, and then really got into it a lot more in the second half and played one of his better defensive halves in a while that we've seen from him, which is, you know, it's a little disappointing that he's not really that great of a one-on-one defender, because he's very upright. You know, he doesn't get into a great stance. He doesn't have a ton of strength, but I thought he did a nice job on Thompson and showed maybe that he's capable of a little more. And this ended up being pretty much a defensive game, 101-87. The Warriors did not score incredibly well, despite the explosion from Durant. And Durant, actually, he cooled down and took some bad shots in the second half, but he and Thompson were the only Warriors to attempt at double figures in shot attempts there.
The other one we should mention, Quinn Cook got his first NBA start. He is a two-way player who played for Duke and was, I believe he was the D-League player of the year last year. And he's
averaging 25 a game in the G-League right now.
And so no one is going to replicate Steph Curry. And I thought the Warriors generally did a very good job of just having him fill a different role. So they wanted him to compete on defense. He was guarding Kemba Walker for the most part, and that, like, because they couldn't really put Klay on him, because then you have all the other challenges. They have big guys, and so they didn't want to go in that direction for the most part. They did a little bit. And so Quinn Cook didn't run a ton of offense. He didn't really gun for his own looks. He took shots when they were presented to him. He ended up 3 of 7 from the field, 2 of 4 from three, made passes when he had to, and defended hard. And really, even without Draymond and Steph Curry, that's all they really needed.
All right, I think we're done on this game. Let's hit a little bit of news. Out of Dallas, Nerlens Noel has been questionable the last few games, and now it turns out that he's going to have surgery on his left thumb. I mean, he's not playing anyway. And Rick said he's been out for several weeks, and then Mark Cuban gave a fawning statement about Noel, how he could have handled this so poorly, and he's out of the rotation, and it's a contract year for him, and blah, blah, and he's still been, you know, a good guy, and he really enjoys hot dogs from the media room at halftime, and he just couldn't be a better citizen, and we don't think he's any good and we're not playing him. I mean, it was just kind of like, you know, Mark just kind of being like, all right, I'm trying to be player friendly here, but didn't really it was just funny to see that statement from Mark.
We actually have a couple pieces of Suns news. The first one is that Devin Booker has a strain of his left adductor muscle. So he's going to be out 2 to 3 weeks. Of course, that will strongly hinder the Suns offense. They will look very different without him. And then the other piece of news is that they are going to become the first team to convert a two-way contract, this one for Mike James, into a standard NBA contract. So that's exciting to get that done. And because the Suns have 15 players on roster, whether all of them are amazing or not is a different question, that means they have to actually clear a roster spot, which is something they're going to have to do in the near term. And unlike most teams, as bad as the Suns have been, there is not really a clear-cut answer here, partially because you don't want to let a guy with a bad contract that runs multiple seasons go right now, because then you commit yourself to whatever decision you make.
Yeah, you can't trade that guy. You can't get rid of him. You can't stretch him. I mean, at least for this year, you can do it for next year still, but he's on the books for this year. I mean, they've got Tyson Chandler, they've got Jared Dudley, they've got Brandon Knight, all of whom might fall into that category. It looks like Woj, his piece on it, presaging that perhaps Derrick Jones Jr. will be the one let go. And if I had to predict, I would agree that it would be him as well, with James having spent the maximum of 45 days on the NBA roster. And I think if Jones Jr. does in fact let go, there are some teams that should claim him. He's a guy who just has some athleticism on the wing, pretty young, only played the 1 year where I think ended up having to leave UNLV. And so airplane mode, as he's called, hopefully he'll be on a team so he can be in the dunk contest again, because Pat McCaw said we didn't see the best from him last year. But also, I think his athleticism, a team should take a chance on him, especially a team that just doesn't have anything really at the three. And the Bulls, who I believe now have waiver priority with it having flipped over to December, now it's inverse order of the standings. Or Sacramento even would be another one too, though who they're going to cut would be trickier. But I think the Bulls, could move on from Kay Felder, who, they claimed him, and I thought that was a good claim, but he's not going to be a part of their long-term plans. And maybe Jones is someone that they could develop, and they certainly have plenty of playing time to give him a shot. They got no one else at the three, and they can try to develop him with their Windy City Bulls franchise.
The other key part of this is that a team should definitely try to claim him, because Derrick Jones, if they want to, is on an extremely team-friendly contract. He has the kind of the latest guarantee dates for the next couple of years, and then even if it becomes that, his final year is a team option. So if he's so good that you would want to have his restricted free agent after in 2019 instead of having him at the minimum, you can do that. And so
and he's on the Hinkie special,
and so that would be a logical thing for a lot of teams, just either if they have a roster spot to burn or a trade exception. Like I think there are a lot of teams that, even though I'm not the biggest believer in him as a player, the sheer urgency and the need for wings in this league means that it's worth giving him a shot.
Now, any player who's on a minimum contract, any team can claim him. However, although Jones is making the minimum, he is not on technically a minimum contract, which may be only 2 years or less. In fact, he's on that 4-year deal. So a team must have either a trade exception or cap space to claim him. And Chicago certainly falls into that category. They have, they're technically over the cap, but that's due to that Butler trade exception. So they could dig into that, or they could renounce the Butler trade exception and claim Jones that way if they want to. Also probably would just use part of the trade exception to stay over the cap still. Brooklyn, another team that I think has the space, they could maybe use another guy who could play some three or four as well. I think Indiana, another team under the cap, doesn't really have anyone who can defend on the wing right now, and we don't need to get into who they would drop. And so we always talk about which of these guys are going to get claimed, but we don't see too many guys get claimed anymore. I think usually most teams' agents or most players' agents are able to kind of finagle it so they don't get claimed and they can go where they want, or if a guy's getting released, there's usually a reason. But I think he has enough physical talent that they should look at him. That's probably enough on him, though. Last thing, Evan Fournier suffering what looks like it could be a significant ankle sprain, had to be helped off in overtime against Atlanta. So the hits continue to keep coming here for Orlando, and we talked about how bad their bench is. And so if he can't go, it'll probably be I probably would just start Augustin and Peyton together, I think would be my approach, rather than elevating Aaron Aflalo.
Yeah, I think that'd be fair. Can we end this with, I don't even need to make a comment on
we do have one more thing too, and that is that Hornets coach Steve Clifford. I had Rich Cho on yesterday, and Rich presumably didn't want to discuss this, and that's why it didn't come up, understandably so at the time, as they've been protective of Clifford's privacy as to the exact nature of why he's taking this personal leave, but it is apparently health related. So Steven Silas, their lead assistant, coached against the Warriors and will probably continue to do so. Clifford had also missed a Monday's game against the Magic, and so we don't know how long this health related issue is going to take, but hopefully it's nothing too serious for Clifford.
So we're I wanted to end this, a game that we did not cover, even though people incessantly asked us on the Twitter NBA show, was Bucks Pistons. And one of the more curious elements of that was Jason Kidd intentionally fouling up four with 10 seconds left. And so Matt Velasquez of the Milwaukee, I think it's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, asked him about it. And this is Jason Kidd's quote. "They're trying to play the game of quick twos to save their timeouts. So we'll just play the free throw game with them. I believe that my guys will make the free throws. If they miss one, it works. It's a free throw game no matter what, but we wanted to send them to the line and it worked out."
Yeah, now, if you're up three, I understand fouling because you don't want to give them a chance to tie. But I mean, number one, you're exposing yourself to a situation where by fouling, where if they make the first and then get an offensive rebound, you're giving them a chance to tie. In theory, you force them to make a three and then you can hit both your free throws and they still have to hit a three. I mean, it's just, and especially to like have less time go off the clock as well while you're fouling instead of just like forcing them to make a shot. I mean, that seems really to make very little sense.
Well, and also, and Kidd, remember, he was saying they're using their quick twos to save their timeouts. If they have to move the ball all the way down the floor, that takes a bunch of time.
No, it's pretty asinine. I mean, the fact that they went back to the trapping last night against the Celtics and then went away from it, I thought is the case too. And Bob Vulgaris had a nice long tweet storm about it. It's always enjoyable there. And I think, Kidd, it's just what always bothers you too is that when you can tell, it's pretty clear that a coach is just not on the same page with the organization. I mean, that's nothing internal that I've heard on that. It's more just that, like, I guarantee you their sports science staff is not saying, "Oh, hey, how about you play Giannis the first 18 minutes of the second half and then give him a rest for 3 minutes and bring him back in." You know, there's no way that anyone believes that that's like the best way for Giannis to recover and like give his peak performance and that would be safest. You know, it's just he is very much just flying by the seat of his pants. He does it with his rotations and he's doing it by feel. And they just, I mean, the biggest thing about it with Kidd is that right now there doesn't seem to be a process involved for his decision making, right? It's very much seat of the pants. It doesn't seem to be where with his rotations, where there's just a plan, there's a process that they're following, that they're sticking to, you know, same thing. I mean, in this sort of a situation, if that's something that you believe in doing, that's something that any modern coach should talk to the analytics department about. And you know, every team basically has someone in analytics who's working with the coaching staff, and you say, all right, you know, this is a, let's consult here, like this is a math problem in the end of games a lot of times, like let's talk about, let's go through a process of determining whether this is the right way to do it or not, instead of, oh yeah, I have this idea, I'm just going to implement it on the fly without even kind of thinking about it.
Mama, there goes that man.
All right, that's a good one to end on. Don't forget about our sponsor today, blinds.com and Movement Watches. And we'll be back tomorrow. Dylan Murphy, going to have him on again. Lots of interesting stuff for he and I to talk about. So we will talk to y'all then.